Welcome to the second half of the technical committee presentation. This portion will be involved in discussing the future of 96 kilohertz 24-bit digital audio, and more specifically what the leading manufacturers of audio, digital audio restoration and editing equipment are doing about 96K 24-bit, specifically Cedar, Sadie, and Sonic Solutions. Say that five times fast. Let me introduce the panel, most of whom you already know. To my immediate left is Dennis Rooney, who is a freelance producer and archival consultant whose most recent work has included work on Sony Classical's Masterworks Heritage Series. And moving down, Joe Patridge, independent recording engineer based in Bronx, the garden spot of New York, and owner of Patridge.
Wouldn't trade it for anywhere else.
Patridge Sound Studios. And to his left, my partner Seth Winter, who is an audio engineer at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive of Recorded Sound, and also who operates his own business, Seth B. Winter Sound Studios. And so I will turn it over to these gentlemen.
I have a couple of, can you all hear me?
No.
Is this microphone? Oh, it's not on. That's a good reason. It's analog.
Audio engineer.
Yeah, I know.
That's
it's
all
a
right.
new invention.
Right.
It's a new invention.
Audio,
I got to get used to.
Don't worry about it.
I may as well start here. I have a couple of papers to read. I think I'll highlight the second one. The first one is a bit extensive, but it will explain a number of things that tied in with the first part that we just saw. This came from Gordon Reed, who's the managing director of Cedar Audio Limited. It's entitled 24-bit audio restoration at a sample rate of 96 kilohertz, which is exactly what this paper is, this presentation is about. It seems simple, doesn't it? If you can remove clicks and crackle and hiss at sample rates between 30 kilohertz and 50 kilohertz, surely you need to only rejig the audio data handling of your process to perform the same job with higher fidelities at 88.2 kilohertz or 96 kilohertz sampling rates. Unfortunately, things are not as simple as that. High-quality audio restoration processes use signal modeling to distinguish between genuine signal and noise. For purposes of this discussion, we can ignore low-quality techniques such as click suppressors, expanders, and various types of low-pass and dynamic filters. The models within each of these high-quality processes have a very clear picture of what is genuine, for example, desired signal, and the job of the algorithm, in other words, what's written into the program, is then to discard and or replace anything that does not fit. Unfortunately, that means that any model optimized for the 44.1 kilohertz sample rates is unlikely to be ideal at 96 kilohertz. The result of trying to quote unquote shoehorn the additional data into this inappropriate algorithm is therefore a deterioration in performance. To retain optimal performance at high sample rates, it is necessary to construct new algorithms designed specifically for these rates. This is quite at odds with common perception, which suggests that by default, audio recorded and processed at 96 kilohertz must be superior to the same audio recorded and processed at 32, 44, 1, or 48. Unfortunately, there's another constraint, that of available processing power. In other words, what is referred to, you may hear the expression DSP, digital signal processing availability. The nature of most common audio processing algorithms, for example, equalization, dynamics, and reverb, is such that a doubling of sample rates requires a doubling of computational power to achieve the quote-unquote same result. Unfortunately, more complicated algorithms, such as those required for audio restoration, have a quadratic or sometimes worse power requirement. Remember what Gary put up where it said 2 to the bit power? Okay, this is where you run into that problem. This means that if we double the sample rate, we need at least 4 times the computational power to perform the same task. If no increase in power is available, meaning you're limited to the board you have in the machine with the amount of digital signal processing and speed, we must simplify the algorithm by a factor of 4, far beyond the point at which its performance is unacceptably compromised. In other words, taking 12 pounds of bologna and putting it into a 4-pound bag. As Alice Cramden once said, I think.
Exactly.
Modern DSP platforms, digital signal processing platforms, now offer the power required for 96 kilohertz audio restoration processes. However, while this removes one otherwise intractable problem, it still leaves us with the huge development cycle implied by the requirement for 96 kilohertz audio restoration with, at the very least, no deterioration in processing quality. This is the problem we keep running into, maintaining the quality we have at the lower sampling rates. First, we must design the new hardware platform. Next, we must develop a new signal model for each restoration process before we can begin to code the process itself. There are also non-trivial problems associated with the data handling and integration of the platform, not to mention the thorny issue of the user interface. User interface means what comes up on the screen, what am I clicking, changing thresholds, changing the parameters, how hard do I want to denoise this, NR3, the noise reduction, taking a fingerprint of the noise and how much of it you want to split and recombine and remove. As you might imagine, the temptation to retain existing platforms and algorithms have proved too great for many manufacturers. The results of their shortcuts are restoration systems whose performances at 96 kilohertz are even more compromised than they are at lower sample rates. Cedar Audio has refused to contemplate this approach. However, it would be wrong to imagine that Cedar is ignoring 96 kilohertz. The first Cedar process designed specifically to handle high sample rates has been available since 1999. This is the Cedar D-Click 96 for Sadie. It is no accident that our first 96 kilohertz product is a plug-in. The process uses a combination of the dedicated Sadie digital signal processing and the host processor to achieve optimal results as efficiently as possible. It still runs outside of real time, but this is no problem because the editing platform provides the user interface and other facilities needed to make non-real-time processing a painless operation. What they're talking about is, I have this, it's essentially after you've processed through Cedar and there's a residual tick or pop or thump, you see it up on the waveform. What you do is, like in Sonic, you gate it and you tell it to de-click it, and you know, the order of a click is so short, but it will interpolate, meaning remove the click and then take information from either side and put it back in. This can take, on Sadie, for each one of those clicks, anywhere from about 5 to 15 seconds, depending on how complicated the interpolation is. It is no accident that our first 96 kill, having launched D-Click 96, Cedar is now developing signal processing techniques that will make other 96 kilohertz restoration processes possible. Some of these will undoubtedly be plugins for other host manufacturers, but I'm confident that some will be the basis for dedicated real-time Cedar systems and rack mount units. Now, here's where it gets a little complicated. This is what he was talking about, why it's so crazy right now concerning doing any sort of restoration in 96. Until that time, a restoration engineer must decide how to obtain the best results from the existing material and the available restoration processes. Consider the following range of possibilities. Number one, transcribe the material at 44.1 kilohertz. Restore it using the Cedar at the same sampling rate. Release the restored version of 44.1. Possibility two, transcribe the material at 96. Restore it to using a less capable 96 kilohertz product. Downsample the restored version and release it at 44.1. Or number three, transcribe the material at 96. Downsample the material, restore the material using Cedar at 44.1. Upsample the restored version, apply other processes, downsample the material, release the final version at 44.1. Now, when you're, yes, Steve.
How come they're not considering doing it at 88.2?
Because everyone's screaming for 96.
But this eliminates all those practices.
This is apparently what they're getting back from the industry of where they say they have to go.
If I could comment on Steve's question,
yeah.
44.1 kilohertz traditionally has been considered a consumer sampling rate, whereas 48 kilohertz, which DAT recorders are all capable of with the flick of a switch, 48K has generally been considered to be a professional sampling rate. 96 is simply double 48, and 192 is double 96. So the idea of 96K was not to make it a multiple of 44.1, but to make it a multiple of 48.
But you eventually have to go to 44.1 in order to make a consumer product.
Yes, that's true, but that's not difficult today.
Without artifacts?
It's not as simple. It's not as simple as converting 96 to 48. which any DVD player will do in playing a 96K recording. You simply drop every other sample is what you do. It's an easy divide by two. But there are sampling rate converters on the market that have been available for a number of years now, like the Analog Devices AD1890 series, that will basically dynamically change any input sampling rate to any other up to about 50 kilohertz. Now, there are new versions of these sampling rate converters that now work from 96 down. And what they basically do is they upsample the existing sampling rate to an extremely high sampling rate. The AD1890 took anything that came in and upsampled it to over 3 megahertz and then simply dropped in the closest points for the sampling frequency you were converting to. I can tell you the AD1890, because it was such a superior clock jitter suppressor, actually made virtually anything that went through it sound better when it came out, if it was implemented properly. I won't get into that, but it was a very good device. It can be done. Anytime you make a change, somebody will hear an artifact. That's always been true. No LP record's ever been cut that sounded like the original tape. Probably no finished digital product for playback in the living room will sound identical to the original digital tape. But it can be very, very good with today's technology.
Okay. He goes into something else here, which I'm going to skip, which is going to get a little crazy. But then he says at the end, until these questions are answered and until there's a complete range of restoration products designed specifically to provide optimal results at 96 kilohertz, your ears must be the judges of the suitability of a process. Do not be misled by the implied promise of high sample rates if there's a real danger that the results will be inferior to those achieved at current sample rates. As always, big numbers quoted in impressive tables of specifications are worthless unless backed up by superlative sound. He also said some commentators and manufacturers link the concept of 96 kilohertz sampling rates and 24-bit word length, the so-called 2496 audio format. There is no reason for this. Cedar Audio is at the very forefront of 24-bit technology, releasing 24-bit 441-448 kilohertz hardware units as long ago as 1992. Now, Sadie sent me something, and I'm not going to go into the whole thing concerning the use of their editor in the sense that they have 8 streams and their 2496 board can handle 96K 24-bit audio in, but it has to split it. That's not what we're worried about. What I wanted to know from them, what modules do not work at 96, as what Cedar was saying here about the incompatibility problems. As far as signal processing goes, all of Sadie's built-in compressors and EQ work at 96K. Most of Sadie's plugins work at 96K as well. These include a de-esser, a graphical EQ, master limiting, and our own high-res dithering algorithm. Our third-party 96K developments include Cedar's 96K D-Click algorithm and POWR's Consortium's POWR reduction algorithm. And they also have something in here, Apogee's UV22 dithering algorithm is not available for Sadie at 96K. But a 96K capable algorithm is in the works. Sadie plugins that don't work at 96K are our time mode time stretching plugin. That's essentially, it makes something slower or faster without affecting the pitch. And another plugin called SynchroArt's Vocal Line. Our Cedar denoise and dethump algorithms are not yet optimized for 96K. So this is coming from two of the major digital companies in this business that you would use either for any sort of editing or restoration. Oh, now I can see everything again. And they're having problems. And what I think is next is I think Joe should speak about what he has gotten from Sonic, or what his experience has been with the other major editing system out there.
Well, first of all, I should say I didn't get anything from Sonic because they never responded to my request. Any of you who know anything about Sonic know that the weak part of the company is their ability to communicate. Thank God they know how to build a great digital editing system. Before I talk a little bit about it, David Hall had asked a little bit earlier about the whole issue of digital editing and what is digital editing. So I thought I would spend 2 or 3 minutes to just explain the concept behind digital editing from a workstation point of view. Essentially, it's sort of like making a quilt. You take a lot of little pieces and you stitch them together. And so you will, you'll take a sound file, which will be on a hard disk. You then tell the computer, okay, start playing this sound file at this time, stop playing this sound file at this time, and go to the next sound file. The point at which the sound files connect is called a crossfade. That is, it's called so because one sound file is fading out while the other file, sound file fades in, and it's the adjustment of that crossfade that creates the ability for seamless editing between these two files. And as you go along, you have all these sound files that you take parts of, and they're connected together by these crossfades. When I was talking about exabyte archiving, I was talking about taking all the original sound files and something called an EDL. EDL stands for Edit Decision List, and it's basically the computer telling the hard drive, start playing this file at this point, stop playing this file, and start playing another file at this point. That's the basis behind computer-based digital editing. That's how it works. It is basically the computer telling the hard drive when to play the files and how the files are connected together, so that if you wanted, say, a longer crossfade versus a shorter one coming in, you could tell, basically the system would tell the hard drive to play and then lower the gain until it is faded out completely while fading in the gain of the file that you're going to. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic. If you have any more questions, ask us afterwards, but that's basically how digital editing works.
Can I just add in one thing? The beauty of what happened when you went to disk editing was that in the earlier versions, even when you did things on reel-to-reel tape, 1630 process was, it was a sequential loading. You had to put things in a specific order as you were doing it. On a disk editor, you can move files anywhere you want. Every project I worked on, the producers who are in this room have worked with me, have seen that 6 months later, we had to go in, we found another source for something, just re-recorded it, moved it into the EDL, and plopped it in wherever he wanted to. I remember being over at Sony 10 years ago with Art Fierro and Bill Lacey working with the 1630s, that if all of a sudden they got a new source, they had to take that 1630, run a dub of it, and then stop it at a point where they wanted to put the new insert in, then continue, put the old 1630 in to make another copy, and then sit there and edit between the two machines. I mean, this is something that literally in real time, if I need to put a 30-second insert into a master, I can do it in about a minute. In the 1630 thing, you would have to rerun that entire master up to that point, do the insertion, then re-edit it, and then go back and verify and make a new master.
There is an upside and a downside to the computer-based editing versus the 1630, although at this point the 1630 is not that viable. What Seth is talking about is called assembly editing, where you go from one take to another and just assemble pieces one after the other. And it is true that the insert capability of the 1630 was somewhat limited as compared to the current digital editing systems out there. Mm-hmm. It's also true that being a tape-based format, it was by definition linear as opposed to nonlinear, which is what any editing system is. So therefore, moving things around is much more difficult in a linear system, as anybody who's done linear video editing would know, right, Joe? The nonlinear video systems that are out there have much more capability to move scenes around than on a linear format like BetaSP, and that was the same problem with the 1630 format, which is essentially a 3/4-inch videotape editor linear system. In a way, it's basically a computer program telling hard drives when to play and playing it into a converter that sends out a digital audio signal and converts the digital audio on the hard drive.
It's essentially like editing a word processing document. You don't want a paragraph, yank it out, take it, and add in something else. It's the same thing.
Excuse me? Well, the downside to computer-based editing is before you do a single edit, you have to load all your sound files onto the hard drives. Mm-hmm. That is often more time-consuming than doing the edits. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have to fix a 70-minute master, and do one insert or change something, move tracks around, whatever, I have to load that entire master into onto the hard drive of the editor. Then I can do it in a matter of minutes. But the process of loading, uploading, and downloading, whereas with the 1630, there was a time when you could use it with a DAT machine to do assembly-based editing without having to ever having to load it. This didn't necessarily make it faster, but at the time it was a little bit more attractive for projects that didn't require a lot of editing. But since that's almost non-existent these days, projects don't require editing, the computer-based workstation is far, far more versatile. Things like the crossfade control on the 1630 were very rudimentary compared to what you can do in a computer-based editor these days.
Absolutely.
All right. In any event, as far as Sonic Solutions, in spite of the fact they didn't respond, I know where they are going with 96K. And they've decided to go into 96K the whole nine yards, all the way. Currently, the system known as HDSP is capable of 8 channels of 96K with a single card. And multiple cards expand the system by powers of 8. So it can go up to, I believe, 96 channels if you actually have 12 cards. They also are in a process, it is only starting now to become available, of implementing the no-noise program to operate fully native at 96K. Sonic took the position early on that 96K was a significant improvement, and they were the first editing system to even offer any 96K capability. When the USP card came out in the summer of 1995, there was an option to be able to do 2 channels of 96K editing using that card. This was in 1995 when there practically weren't any converters out there that could convert audio to 96K, but Sonic had the capability to do editing, and they've been at the forefront at this point. Now, as is often with Sonic, it's like an elephant's pregnancy as far as getting things done. Everything is always behind schedule, and the HDSP system was supposed to be up and running 2 years ago, and I talked to a friend of mine who has an HDSP system, Paul Zinman at Soundbite New York, and every month or so I call him up and I say, so how much money have you made this month with HDSP? And he says, not a dime. The problem is that at this point the system, although it is functional, is quite buggy and is not good for production, especially if you're used to the speed with which a experienced Sonic editor can use the earlier versions of the system. But every release of software has improved more and more of the problems, and I suspect at this point the system is 6 months to a year away from being totally capable at the high sample rates, including the no-noise programs as well.
I think what this suggests is that Sonic, being the Cadillac of digital editing software, is the software of choice among all of the biggest budget major producers at this stage. And they are, every time they introduce a new version of anything, and Joe will back me up in this, one hesitates to embrace the new version since it may be more troublesome than the one it replaced. And I'm not, since I don't work directly with Sonic, but merely sit in a chair while someone else works with it and complains about the bugs, I'm well aware of them, but I haven't been personally frustrated in quite the same way as Joe might be. In any event, it's clear from what Cedar had to say in the document that Seth read that they're not prepared to do any kind of rapid redesign of a system that it's taken them over a decade to bring to its current level of perfection at 16-bit word length. So that while it's clear that 9624 is in use now, on a kind of a semi-experimental basis in the major studios, 16-bit will be certainly the standard for quite some time, it seems to me. There's going to have to be a lot more pressure to rapidly redesign these various devices so that they run native at 96.24.
Well, actually, Cedar said that the problem wasn't so much the 24. Their systems can do that. It's the 96 that's driving them nuts. So.
I did want to mention, since Joe had brought up EMAS, and I'll just say this quickly so that anyone who's on tenterhooks wondering what's happened, Sony's EMAS archival system I described 3 years ago, I think it was, and really nothing has changed. It is still a 16-bit 44.1 system. Its advantage is similar to that of the 1630 insofar as that although it's a longitudinal medium, it uses a proprietary tape cassette. The digital tape analysis feature is even more sophisticated than that of the 1630, so that these cassettes in a master unit are constantly being evaluated for potential magnetic defects, and if anything is perceived as a possibility, they automatically migrate the data to a new cassette in the same system. Apparently, there has been some discussion about changing the word length or the sampling rate, but there has certainly been nothing decided upon, and the archiving process goes on in this system as usual.
Any questions?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I think Seth sort of touched upon it in reading the statement from Cedar. And it goes along with what I said earlier about we don't need 144 dB of dynamic range to record a symphony orchestra or any other kind of music accurately, but the point is you want to get all of your recording above the problem areas in the converters. If 16-bit converters were perfect, in other words, if that entire 96 dB of dynamic range were flawless, we wouldn't need anything else, but it's not flawless. The bottom end of a 24-bit system is not flawless either, although it's a lot better than 16. So we're well above the problem area. We don't really need to make use of that entire dynamic range. But along with what you're asking, whenever you do processing in the digital domain, you lose resolution. If you start processing at 16-bit, by the time you're done with the finished product, who knows what you've got left? You may be down to 14 or 13 or something. And depending on what you're working with, it may not be critical. If you're restoring cylinder material that has very limited dynamic range, you might not miss what you've lost. But if you're working on stereo analog master tapes that are extremely good in fidelity, then you certainly will miss what you've lost. So the idea is, if you do your processing with 24 bits of resolution, by the time you get to your finished product, you've still got something that's very, very good.
Does that affect data migration?
You shouldn't lose any resolution if you're making a straight digital copy. The only thing that will come in, once again, is my good friend jitter. And whenever you're making a digital copy of something, usually the device you're making a copy to has an input receiver that reclocks the data that minimizes the effect of jitter. And of course, most of us for years that are high-end audiophiles, if you will, have used some kind of outboard clock jitter suppressor between our CD transport and our outboard D to A converter to minimize that problem. But the numbers will all get copied. The only thing that can creep in is jitter, and again, with reclocking, there are ways to minimize that effect.
I think we need to talk a little bit about, since this is supposed to be a discussion of 96K, about the issue of transferring of data in this venue. There are some transmission problems and incompatibilities with 96K. This has nothing to do with the 24-bit length, but definitely has to do with the sample rate. Since 96K is twice the sample rate of the highest sample rate, 48K, that was in use prior to going to the high sample rates, it requires the receivers and drivers of the digital transmission interfaces to operate twice as quickly. this has been more of a problem than you would think it should be. Some manufacturers have decided that they don't want to implement faster AES transmitters. And receivers. So they've gone to what's called a dual wire system, as opposed to those who have decided to go for the 96 kilohertz transmitters and receivers, who have implemented what's called a double speed interface. I should also say that of the three popular interfaces that are currently out there, which are ASEBU, SPDIF, and optical, the latter two are essentially unsuitable for 96K, unless they're in a dual wire configuration. At double speed, neither the optical or the SPDIF reliably transfers data.
If I could comment on that. The SPDIF interface can be used at 96K 24-bit, but in order for it to work properly, a couple of things have to be done a little bit differently. First of all, the receiver and transmitter chips, for quite a number of years, there's a company called Crystal Semiconductor, which was taken over by Cirrus Logic. And for many years, at sampling rates up to 48K, at word lengths up to 20-bit, they made an 8412, and there was an 8411 version of it too, input receiver, and an 8402 transmitter. And you would find that if you were going from the output of one digital device transferring data to the input of another device, you might very well inside that device have a Crystal Semiconductor 8402 transmitter and an 8412 receiver on the other end. Crystal Semiconductor has upgraded those chips to 96K 24-bit performance. They have the 8414, which is the new input receiver, 24-bit 96K, which will work with SPDIF or AES-EBU, and they also make, I think it's the 8404 transmitter chip. I just bought a DVD player that has a 96K 24-bit digital output. That's SPDIF. And if you look at the digital output on an oscilloscope, you can see that the clock frequency has changed to the appropriate frequency for 96K. It indeed does work. But here's what has to be done to make it work right. And here's why SPDIF often doesn't work like it should. The SPDIF and the AES-EBU interfaces as well, either of these digital interfaces, they are radio frequency transmission lines. And I don't want to get into RF theory here, but they have to have matched impedance from source to termination. The SPDIF is a 75-ohm transmission line. Now, no radio frequency engineer would ever use an RCA connector for a 75-ohm transmission line. Nobody in their right mind, even for 44.1 at 16-bit. Nonetheless, everybody does it. What you need to do to make the SPDIF interface work properly is to use 75-ohm BNC connectors. And 75-ohm BNC connectors, the kind that have a bayonet, you push them in and you twist, they are not to be confused with the most common variety of BNC connectors, which are 50 ohms. The 75-ohm ones Canari makes. There are a couple of other companies, Amphenol makes some too, but the Canari are the best ones. If you with the appropriate transmitter and receiver, SPDIF will work for 96K 24-bit, but if you use the crappy old RCA connector that everybody uses out of force of habit, it will never work properly. Yes, you'll get a digital lock and sound will come out, but you might not like what you hear.
Well, thanks for the update on that, because I wasn't aware of the the SPDIF capability. Now, Prism, on their 96K A to D converter, did put SPDIF connectors with BNCs on them for the future possibility of transferring 96K either dual wire or single wire. The problem with this system is that some of these formats that I talked about previously will not work with the single wire interface. For example, the DTRS format must use the dual wire interface because it basically splits the signal into two 48 kilohertz 24-bit signals, which are then combined left and right channel. which are then combined to form 196K signal. So it cannot work with the double speed interface. And some other converters simply don't have the dual interface on it. It increases the cost, obviously, because you have to have two AS drivers on it. There are boxes out there that allow for conversion between dual and double speed. But it is something that has to be considered when putting together a 96K system, because there's a lot of incompatibility from one processor to another. I have several processors that only will work with the double speed interface, and a couple of other rigs that have to use the dual.
Okay, one final question, Mike.
I think the answer to that question, Mike, is both. As far as the professional headroom, certainly working at higher bits of resolution and when, you know, and doing the processing, still coming up with something reasonable at the end, that kind of professional headroom is very, very important. But potentially, I think one of the, for me, who's more an audio person than a video person, the potential of DVD is to be able to play in your living room a 96K 24-bit recording. Others may disagree.
No, I'm sorry, just moving the microphone. I think that's a goal that is likely to be reached in some form or another, whether it will be universally adopted or commonly available or available at an affordable price is still something that is to be determined. Yes, Lon.
That's the you mean the deck of things that you've bought from the BMG club?
No.
No? That are, because the Deca Legend series.
I'm sorry. You're right. Deca's not.
Yeah. Deca, who by the way, Deca recordings are no longer sold in the United States under the London label. They're now sold with the Deca label because Universal now owns the rights to both American Deca and the English Deca name. But at any rate, Deca has this series called Deca Legends, reissues of analog material mostly, a couple early digital things also. They are being transferred at 96K 24-bit and then down-converted to the CD format. As a final stage in the process, however, much of the analog material is being dehissed with cedar, which bothers some people, including Mike in the back. We talked about this last night. The editing and so forth is all done at 96K 24-bit. It's down converted to 16-bit 44.1, then put through the cedar dehisser, and then put to the CD master. Certainly, it would be much better if dehissing could be done at 96K 24-bit. But there are some companies that are making DVDs, audio-only 96K 24-bit. To the two that come to mind, Chesky, who has been in the business of doing high-quality reissues of analog material for a long time, they have some 96K 24-bit audio discs that are in DVD format, which is not to be confused with DVD audio, which is something else. And also Classic Records has reissued some of the Vox Turnabout recordings engineered by Mark Obor in the early 1970s, 24-bit 96K. I have a couple of those, and the sound on those played through my DVD player going digitally out 9624 into a 9624 outboard D to A converter is really quite stunning.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yes, of
course. Oh, as a matter of fact, a lot of companies now are, when you mentioned Tony Faulkner, I know what rig he uses. He's doing experimental recording of the DSD format. That's why he's doing it 176K. He's also doing two-channel recording at 96 using the Tascam DTRS format. And I don't know where it's going from there, because ultimately it ends up on standard 44.1 compact disc. But it's probably a hedge against the future, because when some 96K format actually hits the market in a reasonable way, the plan is probably to re-release a lot of these items, re-edit them and re-release them in full 9624 sound. So it is being done.
It's very much like the system that obtained when stereo tape was used as a mastering medium, and yet there was no commercial format even before pre-recorded tape became widely available that it could be sold at. So they basically sat. And in some cases, tapes were forgotten about. It certainly happened at Columbia Records, for instance. Many recordings were made simultaneously mono and two-track quarter-inch stereo. And this began in 57. Well, in some cases, the mono issue was edited and released, and by the time the stereo disc came along, people had just sort of forgotten about the stereo issue, or decided that, not because there was some defect in it, but simply because nobody wanted to go to the trouble of editing the stereo version. And because by that time, you see, they had already normalized on a three-track half-inch format, which gave them the ability to derive a mono and a stereo version from the same piece of tape. So in many cases, some things sat in the vaults for 40 years before they were looked at, discovered, and issued in stereo for the first time. Well, it's 20 past 5, unless there are any other burning questions. I think the bottom line is that 9624 is certainly promises much higher performance levels and will likely be a standard mastering format in the industry. The question remains when it will become widely available in the marketplace, and what form that availability will take, and at what price point, and all of those other things. So the future will decide what's happened in 12 months when we do this again next year. Yes. CDR. I think if I can speak for the panel, and if anyone dissents strongly, they can do so after I speak. I have a little more confidence in the viability of the CDR as a long-term archival storage format than Joe expressed in his comments. We don't really disagree, but my feeling is at this point that the extraordinarily low cost of the media, the reliability in general expressed by people with all classes of machines out in the field that I have heard anecdotally over the past 2 years does not incline me to suspect that the format won't become increasingly robust and reliable in the future. Although there's no question about the fact that a longer word length and a higher sampling rate offers superior audio performance, the 16-bit word properly converted, and I can't emphasize the term properly converted too strongly, is still adequate in my opinion, for an enormous amount of archival use. The likelihood of compact disc machines being available and functional 25 or 30 years hence is a better bet, in my opinion, than any other digital format currently available. The DAT is a fine medium, although supposedly there is a point at which, because it uses metal particle rather than metal oxide tape, some have suggested that it will go through zero magnetivity, which means that all content will be erased automatically. However, no one can predict when that will happen, and you've heard that DATs are functional and in use 10 and 11 years in. No one knew what the length of acetate tape was when it was introduced. Tape was never introduced for anything other than time shifting. It was not a mastering medium. It was not intended to be such. However, when people discovered how easy it was to edit it, it became such because that's what people want, function. That was an industry decision, of course, not an archival one. As it turns out, the stability of certain tape oxide formulations that are 40 and 50 years old is far greater than anything A, available today, or B, available within the past decade. I am prepared to say, and others may disagree with me, that the future of magnetic tape, as I expressed on other occasions before this body, is self-limiting. It is a dying medium. It will die whether the Library of Congress approves or not. From practicality, I am advising my archival clients at this point, and I merely say I am advising them, that I believe that they should embark on a program of DAT and CDR conversion of analog material that is in danger of deteriorating. My personal position, which archivists and institutions sometimes don't like to hear, is that my experience has been with a lot of materials that are anywhere between 30 and 60 years old. Desuetude is the optimal archival choice when possible. If it's well stored and you don't need to gain access to the content, then for heaven's sakes, leave it alone. Because, and particularly if it's on a medium like tape, which deteriorates with each exercise, and where the pack of the tape, when placed back into storage, is critical and requires, frankly, a level of expertise and care that is beyond the ability of most institutional staffs to achieve. All of these things militate against any further consideration of analog tape as a useful archival medium. But as I say, a combination of DAT and CDR at this point with a properly converted 16-bit word length, and if you can afford to do it in 20-bit, that's fine, but that's not practical for most institutions. That is my advice. I leave the floor open.
I would just add one more thing to that, that a very important part of what Dennis was saying is the conversion process. Do not use A to D converters on DAT machines or CD recorders. Get a standalone unit. It will make a difference in the conversion process. And one other little point to make about DATs, at least this is a practice I do, and I think it's a good one. Most of the time when a DAT gets eaten by a machine, it happens when it's loading or unloading. A good policy is never to unload or load a DAT tape except at the beginning of the tape, which means wind it to the beginning after use and then unload it, and always leave at least a minute of blank. In other words, run the tape for 1 minute so you get the absolute time before you start any program content. And this way, if it actually eats the tape in a load or unload, you can open the shell, cut out the offended moment, and splice it back together. It's been done. I've done it myself. And that will give your DATs more of a chance to survive in a situation where a machine, because any DAT machine, I don't care how good it is, how expensive, it will eventually eat a tape. Okay.
I think our chair would like us to wrap it up.
Yes. We're here to be picked at later.
Thank you for your